Hello. The Longview topic this week is fair trade, and specifically we're going to talk about fairly traded coffee in a moment with our guest Paul Morse. To start, let's define fair trade. According to Transfair USA, fair trade is an innovative, market-based approach to sustainable development. We like that. Fair trade helps family farmers in developing communities or countries to gain direct access to international markets, as well as develop the business capacity necessary to compete in the global marketplace. By learning how to market their own harvests, fair trade farmers are able to bootstrap their own businesses and receive a fair price for their products. Transfair continues to let us know that this leads to higher family living standards, thriving communities, and more sustainable farming practices. Fair trade empowers farming families to take care of themselves without depending on foreign aid. So that's a mouthful. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, I'm actually a staff member here at University of Massachusetts Lowell. I manage the New England Consortium, which is a health and safety training program for people who have to deal with cleanup of hazardous waste sites or respond to chemical emergencies. And then while I've been here, I had the opportunity to go through the RESD program, which is a really excellent program here.
Right, and that stands for, by the way, Regional Economic and Social Development. And my family's always asking me, what the heck is RESD? Anyway, I'm interested in how you got involved with the fair trade and coffee in particular.
Well, it probably goes back a long time when in the 80s when I was doing some solidarity work with the New Hampshire Central America Network, and I was concerned about what was happening in Central America, the different U.S. interventions there that were negatively impacting those countries, and which eventually led to the Contra War. And at the time, I'd go into little local natural food stores, and they would have coffee from Nicaragua for sale. And the idea is you bought the coffee, and it helped the farmers back in Nicaragua. It was getting money back in to help their economy, mm-hmm. while there was a worldwide embargo that was forcing the country into very serious depression.
Interesting. How and why did fair trade practices come into being after years of the farmers who produce coffee, for instance, being paid so low for such hard work?
Well, a little bit of the history is that some fair trade relationships actually started quite a long time ago after World War II, while there was sort of this push on development, developing countries and things. There were groups that had done poverty alleviation and work that was also essentially famine relief. So there were international organizations like Oxfam, Serve International, the Mennonite Church. What they realized is that charity wasn't enough, and what you really needed to do is work with people at the grassroots level to empower them and use ways of their own culture. So some of those organizations went into trading, bringing back crafts from fair trade countries and actually paying people what they were worth, not necessarily what the market would bear.
Right, right.
That kind of has evolved over years into coffee being probably, which is the second largest commodity consumed in the world next to oil, consumer product, not including defense. And it was a natural product. You know, historically, people in Central America, Latin America, even Asia, Indonesia, had raised coffee for 500 years. And quite honestly, what had happened to the market is that prices were low, but yet profits were high for a number of corporations. And then what's happened is there are essentially four major corporations that control the coffee market in the world: Sara Lee, Philip Morris, Nestle, and Procter & Gamble. Mm-hmm. And now Starbucks is inching into the fifth place, but they're far below them.
Okay, yeah, we'll definitely talk about Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts, some of our favorite locals.
But again, you know, just to go back into the coffee, where coffee began, mm-hmm. as a fair trade product, is Equal Exchange was one of the primary organizations that had been involved in some of the solidarity work with the Nicaraguan organizations. And they decided that this was a good model. It was actually working pretty well. They weren't quite Equal Exchange yet, but then they decided, let's really form a company. Let's begin to do this. So they've actually been doing this now for about 16 or 17 years.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And they now do about $16 million a year in sales of fair trade coffee.
Now, is this the organization that during coffee hour at churches for instance, they encourage that different churches will buy the coffee and sell that exclusively, and they have these accounts all over the United States in these big churches.
Yeah, so the different social justice committees, a lot of times in the churches, care about these issues, care about these different parts of the world and the people in them. And they just kind of put it together, kind of like I put it together, like my dollar for my cup of coffee is my vote for a different kind of trade system. So if I buy a cup of equal exchange coffee at Brood Awakenings in Lowell, for example, I'm voting for a better trade system. And I think
Excellent. It
makes it easier for people to be committed to some kind of a change and gives them a way to do it.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, and we'll also talk a bit more about the opportunities that we have as community members to impact positive change, especially in the way we buy things. What are the roles of the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund? Do they all have roles in developing economies around the world? And I know that there are some bad feelings associated with these organizations. Tell us a little bit about how they build up and how they break down communities.
Yeah, I'm probably in the wing that doesn't think very highly of those institutions. I mean, there actually is a positive aspect that I can talk about with the World Bank in a second, but generally what they are doing is they don't try to create a trade relationships necessarily built on a fair dialogue or a fair distribution of things. And what they have done over many years is kind of force countries into these agreements that in order to get loans for their economies to do development, they're sort of told where that should go. They're told to privatize their public services, including things like water. They're told to deregulate, you know, no environmental regulations, no worker regulations, that's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strategy to put countries into debt to make them perpetually in a weak position.
Right.
And they're always looking for the cheapest price for resources and labor.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a profit-driven thing. And I think it's basically corporate-driven.
Right, right. Well, fair trade is an opportunity to sort of overturn those practices, evidently. How have foreign farmers and artisans connected with American industries that are willing to pay them higher rates for their goods and effectively bypass the loan systems associated with these big organizations? How have those connections come about?
Well, one of the things I think is so important to fair trade is that it's activist organizations that are connecting with artisans and producers in different countries, groups that care about changing the nature of trade, that are interested in reducing the emphasis on war and spending for war. People that care about the cultural heritage of the people that they interact with. So sometimes it's been people who've traveled, who have worked on those issues and realize that these are people who are very good at what they produce. So why not figure out a system that rewards them better?
Right, that sounds great. Now, in your travels, you've been to Nicaragua at least a couple times. What did you learn about the farmers and their families, well, both from your research, you know, for the thesis, for instance, and your trips abroad?
Yeah, I went in two different contexts to Nicaragua. In 1989, I went down as part of a solidarity organization that was observing the elections there. And I lived with a family in one of the barrios for about a week of that two-week period. I mean, limited snapshots of my life have been to Nicaragua. And at that time, we did similar kinds of things. We toured, we met people in cooperatives, we saw different educational projects, things that were getting off the ground, as well as just kind of looking at the dynamic of the election.
Mm-hmm.
I found it more interesting to go back 13, 14 years later as part of a solidarity organization called Global Exchange, which they do excellent work. And they have what they call reality tours. They call them global reality tours, and you can go to different countries. And the idea is that you tour the country in a connected way. You don't just go to the resort.
And not see really
anything that really goes on. So when I went with Global Exchange, which was actually supported by one of the centers here at UMass Lowell, the Center for Public Health Research and Health Promotion, thought I'd give them a good plug.
Long names, yeah.
I was able to go with Global Exchange, and they set up interviews, tours, meetings with producers. And so we got to meet with people that were doing work like in women's cooperatives or women's organizations or unions, met agricultural farm workers group, a loose union, not really, they don't have no bargaining rights, but they're organizing people.
Right.
And traveled and then spent time just socially with people on their cooperative farms.
Did you notice a difference, you know, in the economic circumstances of the communities since the first visit?
I think I mentioned to you, in some ways it was a bittersweet experience to go back and realize the damage I think that the World Bank and folks had done to the overall economy there. I think Nicaragua's economy is the second lowest in our hemisphere next to Haiti.
In what ways was it damaged?
Well, right next to the airport, there's a huge maquiladora corridor, I guess you'd call it, a corridor of maquiladoras. And we met with some of the union folks there who just talked about what it was like. They had horrible health and safety conditions. I'm a health and safety person, so that was very interesting to me.
Tell our listeners, what is a maquiladora?
It's a kind of a businesses that are set up, production facilities that are set up. A lot of times it's foreign investment that puts the maquiladoras in. They're very concentrated. People all work in a single area. There's one way out, one way in a lot of ways. It's not a prison, but, you know, I would have to say they're generally exploiting workers.
It's a very hard work environment, yes. I've had the fortune of visiting Guatemala a couple times, and there were a few years between visits. The second visit, I normally go to a very small village, a very remote small village. I found that American junk food had invaded the corner store in this remote village, and women weren't, you know, as likely to wear traditional clothes. They're beautiful traditional clothes. The indigenous culture seemed to be just melting away, well, as sort of Western society was seeping in more so. Though I doubt that fair trade had played a role in the changes in that particular village, one can only imagine the speed at which a culture would change when community members have more access to mass media and disposable income. I'm not trying to, you know, make a plea for poverty, but, you know, our culture has a lot of destructive components to it, too, as well, you know, Western culture. I read the standards for fair trade organizations published by the IFAT, which stands for, oh goodness, International Federation of Alternative Traders. And the mission is excellent, Paul, and it would warm the heart of any fair-minded person. There are 9 main standards, including creating opportunities for economically disadvantaged producers and gender equity and child labor rights, just to name a few. But efforts to maintain culture didn't pop out as one of those standards. So do you have any concern, or do any of the fair trade organizations have concern, that the U.S. model of capitalism might contribute to the dissolution of culture as it builds economy through fair trade?
I think that's a great question, because within fair trade, there's sort of different aspects to it. There are fair trade organizations that deal 100% in sort of a fair trade relationship with the local growers. Then you have Transfair, which, to their credit, they're trying to get companies like Procter & Gamble, who market Folgers, you know, some large coffee companies, even Nestle's, to move towards buying 2% of their overall coffee sales as fair trade, which is very meaningful to people back in their communities, but the relationship's not there. So in a way, people can just look at it as, oh, well, we're getting a little more money for what we do. But what's different, I would say, with I use Equal Exchange a lot as a good example in coffee, is because they're a 100% free trade organization. Fair trade organization, and they work on a real democratic relationship, even in, there's a worker-owned business as well. But the idea is that they try to put back into the community premiums. So they, not only do they help with upfront sort of financing, you know, pre-harvest financing, but they help put premiums back into the cooperative. And the cooperatives are set up to be democratically run so that they can choose the priorities of where they might want to invest that money. Given the extreme poverty, I think, of Nicaragua, a lot of times it's pretty basic stuff. It's school uniforms for some of the kids so they can actually go to school.
Right.
Uniforms, not even just building a school, but in other cases it builds, people can build a school, or they can have localized health care. They can begin to market other traditional products as well. So I think that's really key, because that idea of a cultural preservation is very, very important, and you can quickly get exploited. Matagalpa, which is one of the larger cities in Nicaragua, it's really in the heart of the coffee growing region. I had the same reaction you did. I went into a grocery store there, and there were all these cereals, and everything was owned by Nestle's, it seemed like.
Yeah.
I'm saying, oh, there's so much junk here. I think folks in the cooperative who live off in their small farms, one is they often don't have vehicles. It's hard for them to get to town anyway. So the more that they can produce locally, the more they can have.
Right, right.
It's sort of more in the traditions of their culture of growing things in a shade-grown environment, of intercropping, of being more self-sufficient.
Yeah, yeah. And that brings up a couple of good points, a couple of things that I wanted to talk to you about. One is the fact that you emphasize in previous conversations, Paul and I have talked about the fact that workers are forced to migrate to where the work is, and this prevents them from, you know, having a very stable home culture. Can you talk a little bit about that, actually?
Yeah, in coffee, again, it's been devastating. I saw a statistic somewhere recently that 1/3 of the world's population migrates on a regular basis. That's horrifying when you think about it. That's that many people that don't really have a permanent home. In coffee, about 400,000 temporary and 200,000 permanent coffee workers over, this has been the recent history of, you know, the last 10 years or so, are being disenfranchised from their land. They're losing their land, they're losing their jobs, and essentially they're filtering into cities in a lot of cases and going to the maquiladoras.
Right.
Because they have no other choice. And some people don't even have that.
Right, right. We've covered a lot of ground here. We've got a couple more minutes. And I'm wondering if you might talk a little bit about the processes themselves, and I mean the production processes, the farming, especially as they relate to the environment, the health of the environment, and talk a little bit about coffee, too.
One quick example. When I went to Nicaragua in 89, I remember meeting with a woman on her farm. The land was very barren. It was very deforested. And I said, what the heck happened to the land there? And the woman said, well, that was from coffee production. There's a difference between the old kind of coffee production and the kind of coffee production that goes into the for-profit zone. And that's been an effort to move to, like, sun cultivation, to use chemicals, to, you know, you don't grow it shade grown. You grow a cheaper bean that stores longer, that winds up in the coffee cans. But for shade-grown coffee, this has been the great plus of the specialty coffee.
And that's
movement.
Called Robusto?
Yeah, the coffee that I described previously is called Robusta.
Robusta.
And it's robust. It'll survive a lot of things. It's not that good coffee. It's higher in caffeine content for those who need the drug. But shade-grown coffee is tastier, more fulfilling as you drink it. But to just talk about that is, you know, historically, I mean, coffee was originally a crop that people grew locally. It grew under diverse shade trees that provide a habitat for wildlife, you know, birds, butterflies, insects, animals. And in this kind of organic farming, they're using sustainable agricultural techniques. So they compost the coffee pulp, they rotate crops, they don't use herbicides or pesticides or chemical fertilizers. And they also cultivate their food alongside potential cash crops, so that along with coffee, and they can sell bananas, they can raise bananas, cocoa, nut trees, they're developing some food security for themselves, so they can actually be self-sufficient in that way.
Are there organizations that travel to the producer countries and ensure that these environmental standards are met, actually, and also that the workers are educated about pesticides and herbicides and all that stuff?
Yes, that's really part of the fair trade relationship, is actually to have people come back who can provide technical assistance in the growing or the cupping, you know, developing quality, like how you, just like wine tasting.
Yeah, yeah.
You cup coffee. And there are very high standards. In order to get it certified organic and sell it, people have to meet a high standard of quality. So that kind of technical assistance is really valuable. And the other part is people just going back and bringing people back from the cooperatives. Well, we bring them here to the United States to tour and talk about their experience and how this is benefiting them and what are the strengths of a fair trade system. And that's dramatic because, again, it's a different kind of a dialogue.
That's interesting. Well, you provided me with a number of cool website links so I could get more information about this topic. And one site I reviewed is a retailer who sells artisan's crafts, from anything from handbags to pillows. I noticed that the prices were pretty substantial for those fair trade products. They were higher than I'm accustomed to seeing in some of our local department stores. Consumer pricing for fairly traded coffee is comparable to that of standard coffee, so why do some stateside coffee roasters, Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks, decide to purchase coffee at a higher price and reduce their profits, and others don't? I mean, what's the motivation?
And some people do it for a really good reason, is to support fair trade. And then I think your larger firms do it as a way of sort of meeting corporate responsibility and for PR within their own trade associations. So it's good that they do it, but they're not necessarily doing it in a real spirit of, I think, developing fair trade and building. And it's more to sort of, I think, deal with the kinds of pressure they may be getting from local organizations. And a group like Starbucks, I mean, Starbucks would never have begun to offer fair trade if there weren't activist organizations who weren't picketing and protesting in front of their stores. So they try to, okay, we'll go along with the 2% if you stop picketing us for a while. Doesn't mean people will stop, because I think Starbucks has the capability to do much more than they're doing.
Thank you so much for this information. And thank you for your good work related to fair trade and specifically coffee. And we can make an impact through our buying choices. I've got to wind this up real quick. I mentioned that Paul provided a number of links to fair trade related organizations and retailers, and I compiled those and a bunch of other information on the Longview website, which is wuml-longview.org. Again, wuml-longview.org, to access all those useful websites and information and tools concerning other sustainability topics that we've talked about in the past. Thanks for listening. We hope the information was useful to you. And until our next sustainability segment, this is Issa Kahn for The Longview.
WUML
Lowell. WUML
Lowell. WUML Lowell.